Welcome. This is the Matthew Bronson Show, and we are here today with Rick Adesso, the executive director of El Pueblo Community Services, right here in, I was going to say beautiful Placidas, but you're in beautiful Bernalillo. 40 plus years.
Yes, 1976 was the beginning.
Amazing.
It's pretty incredible that they've been able to provide continuous services for that long a period of time without any direct federal funding.
Without. And they said it couldn't be done.
Most people don't realize that. Even when the feds come and inspect us, they're like, we're amazed that you're still here after 40 years with no federal funding. So
thanks for nothing.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't get federal funds, why do they have to inspect you?
We actually were considered an FQHC lookalike, so federally qualified health center lookalike. What we do get is a prospective payment rate for Medicare and Medicaid. So we get more per Medicaid visit and more per Medicare visit than a private doctor in the community would, because we don't deny anybody access to care. So nobody's turned away based on their inability to pay. And for that, we get to jump through all these hoops. But we do get the higher rate for Medicare and Medicaid
business. So it kind of evens out.
It works out. It works out well, yeah.
Do you have any significant percentage of your patient population that is unable to pay?
Oh, we have a sliding fee discount program. So folks that are less than 100% of the federal poverty guideline will qualify for that. And it's scaled based on family size. And we have a percentage of people probably, it's gone down since we expanded Medicaid in the state. So we're probably looking at less than 10% now that are on our sliding scale, which generally means they pay a $10 copay when they come for a visit. And if they don't have the $10 copay, we still see them.
But sure.
We don't turn anybody away.
So what is a community health service?
Well, we're basically a primary care provider. We have two nurse midwives on staff, so we do prenatal care as well. And we have currently four behavioral health counselors. We have two of them set up down the road from the clinic. We have a licensed clinical social worker at the high school. She's seeing the kids at the high school. And then we contract with UNM for a psychiatric nurse practitioner who basically does medication management for people with psych med issues.
What about people who just are on pain management for injuries?
That's part of primary care. But depending on the extent of their issue, say, with pain, they'd probably get referred to one of the pain management clinics in town.
Okay.
That's a better place for them. If they got severe pain issues, they need to be managed by somebody who just does that. It's kind of like a specialty thing. So.
Yeah, we decided that, about 10 years ago? Yeah. Prior to that, my primary care could do it for me.
Yeah.
So I assume that has worked out for the best?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have to pay attention to the opiate crisis. And I think the state of New Mexico has done a great job with that. They, a few years back, started making mandatory trainings for all the medical providers in the state. And the Board of Pharmacy, the New Mexico Board of Pharmacy, also now monitors very closely how many opiates each prescriber is prescribing. So that's had a huge.
But they've also exposed the truth about how the pharmaceutical companies manufactured it.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I don't think it was necessarily abuse by the doctor if the doctor is told this is not addicting.
So, that was incredibly misleading. It would be an understatement to describe how the pharmaceutical companies.
But it has, to some extent, hurt people who could really benefit from it, because you have to jump through so many hoops to get an opioid.
Yeah.
That it leaves some people untreated to the extent they should be.
Hopefully not too many. I mean, hopefully we've got enough in terms of the pain management clinics that we have in town in Albuquerque that we can handle the people that really need it there.
Right.
It's safer that way.
So a community health service is just like going to a doctor's office.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's more of an administrative governmental label than a as a patient, I shouldn't go, well, that's a community health clinic. I want to go to...
Well, yeah, some people, you know, I ran into that when I was working in Santa Fe. You know, I had one doc that I hired who was a urogynecologist, so pretty rare breed there, right? And I was really happy to get her, and she finally had to stop working for me because all the referring physicians told her, well, my patients don't want to go to the poor people's clinic. So, and there's some perception of that, you know, but we have a really diverse population that we serve. Probably 50% of our patients live in the 87004, the town of Bernalillo zip code.
Right.
And then 25% of them live up here in Placitas and the other 25% in Rio Rancho. That's a real rough because the other portion of our population, patient population that's growing are people from Albuquerque zip codes. I have to report to the feds every year any zip code that has more than 10 people in it. And 5 years ago, I was reporting maybe two or three Albuquerque zip codes. I report all Albuquerque zip codes now.
And to what do you account that, attribute
lack
that to?
Lack of access. Absolutely lack of access. People will come up, they'll come up to see Dr. Hartman and say, yeah, I couldn't get an appointment in Albuquerque for 6 months or 8 months, so I decided to come up and see you.
Well, you know, whether you want an appointment with Dr. Hartman or any of your medical professionals, it's a rough ticket to get.
It's a rough ticket to get. Generally with him, a little bit with Dr. Rankin because of what she did, and I really want to talk a little bit about that too. But Right now, before things got crazy with this virus, you could get in to see a provider within 2 weeks in our clinic. And it's still that way now. But, you know, Dr. Hartman took over Dr. Firestone's practice. So he, you know, he inherited a huge mature practice. And then Dr. Rankin, which makes it tough to get in with him. We know that. Dr. Rankin, who had been with us for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, took a leave of absence to go do a palliative care fellowship at UNM. So she was gone for a year. And now that she's come back, she's basically 3 weeks a month with us. And then 1 week, this week, she's inpatient at UNMH. So that has kind of decreased our access a little bit. But we brought on a new nurse practitioner who actually started seeing patients in September. And she, I think she saw like 48 new patients last month. So she's getting pounded with all the newbies.
Right.
And we have plans to bring on another nurse practitioner next year when she graduates from her program. Because we also use a locum tenens provider from UNM for people that can't get in to see Dr. Hartman primarily. And we've done that for a good 6 months now. So
you had a gentleman from UNM.
Yes, yes.
Is that who you're referring
no,
to?
No, he left. Stephen, his name was Stephen.
Yes.
Also, he left. His partner got into a school program in North Carolina. So he's actually working for a community health center in North Carolina now. Had a long conversation with him about what that would be like. And now we have Sarah Friedberg, who's a new grad. I think she might have graduated in Stephen's class. And so we've got her plugged in now for overflow. So,
you know how they say you don't want to be the heart surgeon's first patient.
Yeah.
So if you have a nurse practitioner who last week was a student.
Right, right.
Just personally.
Yeah.
I'd like someone to be bloodied by battle, as it were.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing that we do, all of our providers do, is they precept, they teach students. So we're in a position, generally, when we're hiring somebody, we know them.
Right.
We've been able to watch them for an extended period of time. In this case, the last one, we didn't know because she didn't come out of the College of Nursing program, who we worked very closely with. But we knew the doc that she worked with at Sandoval Regional Medical Center very well, and we're able to rely on his assessment of her capabilities. So we're, and the woman that I'm talking about that we'll bring on next fall, she's been precepted by Dr. Rankin, so we know her. We know what she can do. Yeah. And the thing is, the whole teaching aspect of it is so critical. We have a shortage of every type of provider in this country. We don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, nurses. We just don't have enough. We don't have neurologists. We don't have enough dermatologists. And that's going to be a huge factor for those of us who are past 60 already.
Yes.
Because we're in an age where my peers who have been my doctor for the last 20 years are wanting to stop working. And there's not a whole big pipeline behind them. It's going to be a problem. You know, in the state of New Mexico, I think right now we're like 20th, somewhere thereabouts, population-wise, over the age of 60. In the next 5 years, the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to move from 20th to like second. We're going to have this large demographic group of, I'm one of them, so I can say it, old people.
Right.
And we're going to have a tough time taking care of them because we don't have if we don't have enough providers. You know, right. We have an organization. I'm on the board of directors for New Mexico Health Resources, and they exist solely to recruit providers of all types to the state of New Mexico. They get funded by the New Mexico Department of Health.
Right.
And it's an uphill battle. It's a really an uphill battle. I think we're winning. But we got to stay at it. We got to keep teaching kids like we do at the clinic.
Will insurance reform remotivate people being interested in becoming physicians again? I remember 10, 15 years ago, I was seeing a doctor on a regular basis, and he said, I just want to make as much as my senator. And that's kind of sad.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's interesting for us because the people that gravitate toward our clinic for teaching, we've established such an incredible reputation in the community, in the education community, in the healthcare education community, that people are like constantly knocking on our door because they know what kind of experience they're going to get. And I think that, I think that it's really important to them that they're part of a community. They don't want to be part. There's plenty, I'm not going to mention names, but there's plenty of larger organizations that they could go to work for in the greater Albuquerque metropolitan area, and they want to come to work for us because we're just a little bit more personal.
Well, and family practice,
yeah,
appeals to people the same way dermatology appeals to somebody else. To me, never having had any interest in going into the medical field, I would think that family practice, for me, Matthew, it wouldn't float my boat.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I want something a little more hands-on, a little more, I don't want to say more action, but this is more sniffles, and if it's, not to minimize it, but it's not it's not big time.
Yeah.
If there is, and this is a good point about El Pueblo, at what point after you've seen one of the primary cares does it get passed off to someone else? Because insurance-wise, it almost seems like I have to go to a primary care before I can go see the guy that's actually going to treat me.
That's part of the mess in our healthcare delivery system, Matthew. Some of the insurers now are doing away with the whole referral process. There's like, I would say 50-50 split right now. Half of the ones that we deal with on patients' behalf are self-refer. You can self-refer. You can self-refer. And then the other half, it's like we spend an inordinate amount of time trying to get your appointment booked for dermatology because XYZ insurance company says we have to. It's just a barrier to care. It's
and
ridiculous.
Sometimes the dermatologist, even if you have a PPO, which should allow you to go direct, they still want a note from your doctor.
Yes, absolutely. That happens all the time.
So that creates more expense for the patient.
It does.
And I mean, if I have, I don't know what, I guess I could have some kind of mole at this age in my life that fits all the things, you know, asymmetrical red edges.
Right.
I know that El Pueblo is not the right place for me.
Yeah. Although we could do a punch biopsy and send it out for path.
But you wouldn't do the ultimate treatment.
We could. It could come back negative. If it came back positive, then you'd get referred. So we've done those.
Why not just take a little liquid nitrogen or what? I mean, with the dermatologist.
We do that too.
So why go to the dermatologist?
That's more of a Dr. Hartman question than I. Okay. Or a personal preference. You may want to go to see the dermatologist.
Oh, just.
You know? I show him these things I have in my son's like, dude, do I need to worry about this? Nah, it's okay. No.
Just put a little wart away or tobacco and duct tape in what they used to put on warts.
I think so. No. I think so. Yeah. So yeah, but we do that. We'll do, you know, treatment with liquid nitrogen. They'll do punch biopsies, you know. And again, depending, they're going to assess. If they look at it and go, ooh, you need to go to dermatology. if they do that, you want to go to dermatology.
If they go, ooh.
Yeah, you want to go to derm. So
you still do blood testing there?
Yeah, yeah.
That's super convenient.
We have, we were with Tricor, And we switched October 1st to LabCorp, and Tricor had a phlebotomist in there half a day, and LabCorp we have a phlebotomist all day now, which is a great convenience.
So you kind of sublet it. You just kind of sublet it to them.
Well, we just gave them a room, and okay. We gave them a room and a place to put their equipment. And now, yeah, it's much more convenient for people. We've been talking about what we're going to do now. We kind of have a side door we could bring people in if things get really squirrely.
Right.
But folks still need their blood work. You know, we can kind of cordon off a side door and, you know, have a concierge to take the person. No, you need your blood drawn. Come this way.
Okay.
Kind of deal. We've been thinking through a bunch of permutations here.
So if I happen to be at a different physician that wanted me to do blood work, I could come to El Pueblo and have it done there?
That gets really squirrely, because what'll happen is if you come to us to do your blood work, say for your cardiologist,
right?
There's a reasonably good chance that it won't make it back to your cardiologist.
Okay.
There's a reasonably good chance of that. And the other bad part about that is the system for communication between specialty providers and primary care providers does not work. It just doesn't work. So you go to your cardiologist, you go wherever they tell you to go to get your blood drawn, and your primary care provider is probably never going to see that blood work.
You know? Well, that can get messed up too, yeah. Because physician XYZ wants me to go to blood testing ABC.
Mm-hmm.
But my insurance will cover me on
correct
QRS.
That happens all the time. Yep, that happens all the time. It's absurd.
So is that a patient's responsibility to wrestle that all out? Or
yeah, if you don't want to get a big bill.
Well, what happened to the Affordable Care Act and make this all work perfectly?
Well, yeah. Right now, we're using LabCorp, and they're contracted with every major. Actually, they're contracted with every insurance company that does business in the state of New Mexico. So that's, I think that's really important that we have that in place so that you guys don't have to worry about it as patients coming in. We know that they're contracted. Yeah, you go to your cardiologist, it could end up being a different game. They may send you to a different lab that's not on your insurance. So that's where, you have to be a savvy consumer and know, what's on my card? Where can I go based on what they tell me? And then the sad part is you can't even trust the insurer's websites.
Right.
You know, you go to the insurer's website and it says, oh, Dr. Harmon's not contracted with this insurer. And patients are calling us, well, how come Dr. Harmon's not contracted with this insurer? Like, well, he's contracted. Well, it's not on their website. You know, then they'll call customer service for the insurance company. Oh, no, we're not contracted with El Pueblo. We're contracted with everybody. Right. You know, yeah. We need to be.
Sure.
And we want to be, just, again, for access. Access is so important for patients, you know. If they're sick or they're not sick, they want to be able to contact their provider. And they can't contact their provider. That's why we've been bringing in people from UNM to help us. They at least have a fallback, you know. And, you know, the communication between our provider group is incredibly strong. You know, they're all back there kind of in a bullpen.
Right.
And they, you know, if the UNM provider comes out and it's Dr. Hartman's patients, and, you know, she can go up to him and say, hey, what about this guy? What about Rick? What, you know, and you know, the communication's incredible. I'm very impressed with
it. Internal.
Yeah.
Why is it so bad between all the other medical professionals and organizations? And is that unique to New Mexico, or is that a national crisis?
National. When George W. Bush was elected, he appointed an HL7 czar. I was on multiple national phone calls with this HL7 czar. And then 9/11 happened. So the job of the HL7 czar was to have everybody communicating on the same platform. And if they weren't communicating on the same platform for the medical records part of it, they had interoperability so they could talk to each other. Well, that died with 9/11, and it was barely resurrected during the Obama administration. And I mean just barely, but nothing happened with it. It's almost like every new administration like tries to tangle with it. So there's a little bit of funding that's come out of this administration to look at how to do that interoperability.
Is that what it all comes down to, is it needs to get funded? Because that happened at 9/11 with all the law enforcement couldn't talk to each other.
What happened? It's not a function of funding. It's a function of you use provider X for your electronic health record. I use provider Y for my electronic health record. Theoretically, they should be able to just go and right. talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Why don't they?
I don't know.
Money talks. So you know, it's like, it's going to cost me X amount of dollars to have my software talk to that software. And it's not like it's just one software out there. There's like, I don't know, 100 of them.
But it just seems to be such a small issue in today's technological computer programming. It's like saying, if I have a Samsung phone, I can only talk to another Samsung. I can't talk to another Android phone.
That's a great analogy. That's a perfect description of what it is. And it's everybody wants to stay proprietary on the medical record side. You know, what are they
afraid
of?
Well, that's what the Fed's for, when we went from black and white TV to color TV, and that's why we don't have as good color TV as Europe, because you had to be able to receive the black and white picture on your color TV.
Right.
And we're cursed with that till today.
So right now, the New Mexico Primary Care Association, we're members of that body, they got funding from the feds to put together what's called a health center controlled network. And one of the pieces of the work plan for the HCCN is that in the state of New Mexico, and this will only be in the state of New Mexico, we're going to work to develop the mechanism to have everybody talking to each other, because it's doable. It's doable, but it's just it's going to take, like you said, the federal government telling the software companies that they have to do it. And we're getting there.
You build the highway before you build the shopping center. Mm-hmm. If we want to and supposedly have, you know, affordable care for everybody or a national health of some kind, mm-hmm. wouldn't that have been step one?
Oh gosh, it should have been part of it. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It drives all of us crazy. Because, you know, you're going in to see your primary care provider, and you've been off to see the cardiologist, and you've been off to see the urologist or the gynecologist, and you show up on your primary care provider's desk and say, oh, well, yeah, Dr. X told me I should be doing blah, blah, blah. Didn't you get his note? Nine times out of 10, we're going to go, no. You know, so we've gotten really good and proactive at searching. Like, let's say we referred you to a cardiologist, and now you're coming back 3 months later, and we're like, okay, we know he went to the cardiologist. Where's the record?
I don't think we're the only ones. I have a family member who needed a scan or something.
Uh-huh.
Went and got the scan through the imaging company. There's a patient portal.
Yeah.
It was on our computer that day.
Wow.
Printed it off and took it over to El Pueblo, because we knew it would be a week or never
to get
that you got
get
it.
To us. Yeah, exactly.
That's craziness.
Messed up. No, that's messed up. And the time and effort part of it that our staff have to put into that is just, it's maddening. It's just maddening. And again, if you were all one healthcare system, that wouldn't be an issue. talking to each other. You know, we're just a disparate.
Can't the AMA system. Or somebody or Jack Torres, can't he make that happen?
Jack can't, I don't think. I don't know if Jack would want to tackle that. But no, the AMA, I don't think they care. I really...
Insurance companies?
They definitely don't care.
Okay.
Because that might mean they might have to pay you quicker. No, God forbid. They want to do everything they can to not pay
you. So you got everything against you.
For what? Yeah. Oh, totally. It's totally stacked against us. But I think with this little HCCN that we're doing with the Primary Care Association, I'm certain that that funding came out of the feds. And there is definitely a strong push in there to create the connectivity between different software vendors. So we'll see. I'm part of that group. We'll see. I think we've got like 2 years of funding for it. And by 2 years of funding, I mean that goes to the primary. We don't get any money. That goes to the Primary Care Association. And then they take their staff to kind of coordinate what do we have to do to make these things happen. Right. So
I would think, because if there's money in it, someone's going to figure it out. One of these super-duper programming companies, a Google or who knows, the companies we don't even know exist, and that they could write code like universal translators. You can talk into your phone now, and it'll give you Chinese.
Yeah.
Why can't I'll just figure out a way to take any input you want to give me and spit it out in this one format?
There is no doubt that the ability to do that exists yesterday. It has existed for years, but all the vendors want it to be very strict and very proprietary about.
But you get this new vendor that's going to give you that 85 mile per hour carburetor.
You know, I'd like to be on the front end of that one.
Well, let's start a Kickstarter.
There you go.
You know any programmers?
I do, actually.
Well, we're doomed from the get-go. All right, so in my day-to-day life, I fall down, my arm hurts. No bones, but it hurts. Mm-hmm. Do I go to El Pueblo? Do I go to the emergency room? Or the bigger question is there a trigger point where it's like, no, don't come us, go to the emergency room?
I mean, that's going to get triaged when you call in. You know, if you're an established patient, you're going to have one triage line that you're going to go. We've had people walk in accidentally like cut their fingers off and they're bleeding. And
do they have the fingers?
They need to see ortho. So we just kind of wrap them up and send them off to orthopedics because we really aren't equipped to do that kind of surgery kind of a thing. So if it's a non-surgical thing, generally we're going to do our best to get you in and get you seen. If it's something, you know, larger, then we'll probably refer you out. Having said that, everything's going to change for the next 2 months probably.
Right.
And I can't even begin to speak to what that's going to look like. I went yesterday and purchased Zoom for the clinic. I purchased the business package of Zoom. I have one of our behavioral health providers flew back from New York City on Saturday. She's working from home. And one of our other providers had some underlying health issues that made her nervous being out and about. She's working from home.
What is Zoom?
Zoom is a meeting platform. It's a very very common meeting platform. I've used it maybe once, but it is very
It's audio
common.
And video?
Yes.
So
yes.
If you're as old as we are,
yes.
I'd be like a GoToMeeting?
Yeah, or Skype. Skype, okay. It's much more robust. Yeah, like definitely like GoToMeeting, which is still used. Still use that. But yeah, it's a little bit more robust than Skype or GoToMeeting. So we put that
in place. So is that telemedicine?
Yeah, we put that in place. And it was kind of interesting because today, after his press conference, the president came out with this new thing regarding, you know, HIPAA and telemedicine. They're relaxing the standards. What's that?
The president?
That guy.
Okay.
The press release came from Washington. So we're going to be doing more of that during this virus episode. Like we had talked about earlier.
Well, you mentioned the virus.
Yeah.
Be more selective if to determine if I need to come in. You may have a cold. You may have the flu. Mm-hmm. There's not a bunch that can be done. So don't burden the system unless you really think you're ill.
Part of it's burdening the system, but the other part of it is doing everything we can to not expose you to potential infection from the virus. That's the bigger piece there. So like if you're at home and you can take your own temperature and you've got some symptoms and you call, say, yeah, I just took my temperature and it's 99.8. 100.4, by the way, is the threshold that most people are using to start to be worried about.
That's a serious fever of 104.
Yeah. No, 100.4.
Oh, 100.4.
And when you start talking 100 and 203, then they're going to say, yeah, you probably have the virus.
So if I'm over 100, I should seek some kind of attention?
Yeah, most definitely. I would think that would just be safe. So yeah, again, we're going to triage you. You're going to be talking to...
And that just means I'm screened.
Yes, okay. Yes. Yeah, you're going to get screened.
I see blood and gauze and IVs when you say triage.
No. You're just going to get screened by either a registered nurse or one of the providers. You might get a preliminary screen from the front desk staff because we're kind of training them, you know, in terms of they can't do medical triage. They can't do medical screenings, but they can screen you as to where they should route you to get, you know, you.
Right, you got a decision tree they go
down. Yeah.
So. Now, your lobby is kind of like at the airport. It's like, you know, 10 seats and 3 rows.
We had that discussion when we were on the phone call today with Human Services Department and Dr. Sprace. Right. And he actually said, I believe what he said was, it would really be nice if you didn't use your waiting rooms. And I totally understand what he's saying because it's, again, we're talking no large gatherings, you know. And thinking about it just now, talking to you, Matthew, we probably need to, like, take some chairs out.
Put ribbon across it or something?
I know they're doing that in restaurants now. We're like, one table with the white tablecloth you can sit on, and then the other one you don't sit on because they're maintaining the social distancing because that's another transmission
factor. I came up with an idea of for a pet rock, mm-hmm. but it's like a 6-foot diameter hula hoop. That I could put straps on and wear like suspenders.
Yeah.
And that'll keep everyone six feet away from
me. Nobody get within 6 feet of you. Yeah, there you go.
I'll be on Shark Tank next week. It is hard to believe at first glance that 6 feet is going to stop all this. Mm-hmm. Yet, I guess it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something so simple.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, 6 feet and stay out of like closed quarters, you know? Small building with 50 people in it, not good. It's just not good. You know, it's too much chance.
There. Are you, you go out to eat a lot? Well, I guess.
Not anymore.
You stopped.
Yeah. And I've been trying to go to the grocery store in the morning, you know, just to minimize my exposure to other people. Yeah.
There's another reason to go early in the morning. Especially if you eat a lot of vegetables and stuff. Not as many people have handled it at that point.
Exactly. No, that's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
And we need to wash with vinegar. Yeah. Or peroxide is good too.
No, soap is fine. Good soapy.
No, for the fruit and vegetables.
Oh, for the veggies. Yeah. Yeah, no, I thought you were talking about the hands. No, it's just good soapy stuff for the hands for 20 seconds.
I did see something on the tube about, and this came from Tito's Vodka. This is not hand sanitizer. It's 40 proof. It has to be 65%. We appreciate it, the confidence, but don't wash your hands with Tito's Vodka.
Yeah.
$1 million of free advertising.
Exactly. Yeah, that thing went viral. I remember that one. So,
as the guy who knows, you... How about takeout? You'll do that?
Oh, yeah. We go to the La Casita food truck around the corner for Frito Pies all the time.
And when's their last health inspection?
I don't know. They've been there for a while, and we're still living. So
okay.
It's like me. I hunt wild mushrooms. I'm still here. So
Well, that's part of the issue here, Rick. And we are speaking with Rick Adesso, the executive director. Like I say that, the executive director of El Pueblo Community Health Services right here in Bernalillo. I'm all in for staying home, probably going to take a little break from interviews just because, I'm not sure exactly why, but because sporadically go to the grocery store when needed. think about it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. What could I get so I can extend my 3 days in between to maybe 5 or 7 days mm-hmm. in between? But you get rock fever or stir crazy. Mm-hmm. Don't go out at all. Is Rick's the prescription?
You know, I mean, my kids were, I was texting with my boys last night, and they're like, "Dad, don't go to work. Stay home. It's like, I got stuff I got to do, man. I think it's an individual decision. I think be sensible about it. Like, I never used to go to the grocery store and come home and immediately wash my hands. I now come home, I immediately wash my hands, I take the stuff out of the bag, I put it in the pantry, I put it in the freezer, I fold up my reusable bag, and I wash my hands again.
Do you change your shoes? And yeah, maybe I didn't change your jacket?
I didn't change my shoes, nope.
Some of people are saying have an indoor-outdoor clothing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you could get that far. You know, I think being sensible, my whole thing was like, part of the reason why I don't want to go to the store when it's busy, and I can gauge by the parking lot at the grocery store out in El Dorado,
right?
The lines are going to be too long, so there's no way you're going to maintain social distance.
They've turned all of us into cashiers.
Yeah, that's true. That too. Yeah,
but you know, the parking lot can give you a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
I've often gone in and there's no one in the parking lot, and the place is mobbed.
Packed. Oh, wow.
In reverse.
And the other thing I do differently that I never used to do, I carry my reusable bag, right?
Right.
And I don't pick up one of them carts or anything. I just pull my stuff in the bag and then dump it out when I get to the checkout counter. Or if I'm able to, I use the self-checkout thing and just avoid it altogether, avoid the line.
Which everybody has touched.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why you wash your hands as soon as you get home.
you don't wipe the machine down first?
No.
No.
I don't. I've seen people do it.
Do you spray your bags?
No. Nope.
Well, is there now any real factual data on coronavirus that on your hands it'll last a day, on cardboard it'll last a year?
I've seen multiple numbers on that. I'm not really good to speak to that. I think obviously they feel like the hand washing piece is critical, because if you touch something and it got on your hand, you wash your hands, it's gone.
Right.
But yeah, I've seen stuff from 3 to 6 days maybe that it would stay on different surfaces. But again, what is the other thing they tell you not to do? Do you remember?
Touch your face.
Yeah, yeah. And
washing hands is not an actual number, but you know, a million times better than the hand sanitizers.
Yes, absolutely.
The way to go.
Absolutely, yeah. Soapy. Get it really good.
Get a nice
soapy
little scent to
and
it.
And switch songs. You know, if you get bored, you know, I switched to, I found the Gloria Gaynor did a little meme of I Will Survive, you know,
right.
The beautiful song. And so I was singing that for a while. I've kind of migrated to, I can tell you this.
Yeah.
I migrated to Long Black Veil. Because when I'm in the washroom at the clinic,
right,
and I'm washing my hands over that sink, and I actually sing it out loud, it really resonates nice off that porcelain sink.
Oh,
it makes me sound like I could sing.
Like singing in the shower.
Absolutely. So sing in the bathroom now, too.
Some more good things about El Pueblo Community Services over at the high school.
Yeah.
Did you say that you have a licensed clinical social worker there.
She worked for the previous sponsor of the clinic. So prior to this past funding cycle for school-based health clinics, anyone really could respond to the RFP and sponsor a school-based health center. And last year, the Department of Health, Office of School-Based Health, decided, no, you have to be a medical provider. So the previous sponsor there was a consortium of educational organization based out of Las Vegas, New Mexico. And the woman that is working with us now had worked with them for 3 years. So she knew the kids, and she wanted to stay. So we were really happy that she stayed.
Is this the equivalent of our high school where we had a school nurse?
No, this is way different. There is a school nurse in the high school.
That works for the county?
Works
or for the school district?
School district, yes. Yeah, we're independent. We have space that they allocated to us there. And so the LCSW currently is working from home here in Placitos. She before school closed was there Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And she was so busy seeing so many kids that we want to put her in there 5 days a week once school reopens. There was a counselor coming from Five Sandoval that was using that office that she's in on Wednesday. So we have to negotiate the space. But my plan is to have her there 5 days a week because there's great need.
So. When is there this type of professional across the state and across the country, or just Bernalillo or Sandoval County School District?
Oh, anyone who responded to the RFP for school-based health clinic would have been required to have some sort of behavioral health person in there, whether or not they were an LCSW or LPCC, right. Some other designation of...
What happened when the school district decided that you needed an emotional support person there?
It's kind of interesting because I think Michelle Lujan Grisham was Secretary of Health during that time. Okay. It was during the Richardson administration that the first funding came out for school-based health
centers. And it had happened in other states? Or
I don't know. I wasn't paying that much attention then. That was like a long time ago.
So what does the RFP say? What's the need?
Oh, the RFP says you will provide X number of hours of coverage for behavioral health and X number of hours of coverage for primary care medicine.
And what's the process for the student, or I guess teacher too? Or
yeah, we see teachers, we see staff.
But they probably need it more than the students. But why would a student, what's happening that they would go, I want to go see so-and-so?
Confidential services.
Okay.
Students are entitled to confidential services for behavioral health and for family planning, and they utilize them.
If this were available when you were in high school, would you have gone?
Probably not.
Is it normally self-motivated by the student? I feel like I'm what's my line? Student or the teacher goes, hey, whatever.
I would say 95% of them are not teacher referrals. They're the kids know because the clinic had been there for like 3 or 4 years before. So the kids knew it was there.
Word of mouth.
Prior to us coming on, the services were very limited. I believe last year the behavioral health person was there 2 days a week. And when they did have a nurse practitioner, he or she was there 1 day a week. So when I interviewed the social worker, when I was anticipating responding to the RFP, I said, what's the need? She said, I always have a waiting list. I said, so you're here 2 days a week and you always have a waiting list? And she said, yeah. I said, well, would you be cool if we get funded to be here 4 days a week? She said, oh, it'd be fantastic. And she's been busy right out of the box 4 days a week. So, and then we have a nurse practitioner in there 4 half days a week as well. So 4 mornings. And the reason it's for the mornings has to do with the school schedule.
Right.
It's like 7:30 to like 2:30 or something. Plus there's a lunch hour. So we put one of the primary care providers in there 4 mornings a week from 8 to 12. So we're providing pretty good coverage there.
I'm going to assume you have to report on all these metrics.
Yeah.
Are there categories that the state wants you to fill out, like family issues or?
What I report to the Office of School-Based Health is they get every diagnosis that was associated with any visit that kid had. So they'll see, like, one kid could have 4 or 5 different diagnosis codes for a psych visit. Mm-hmm. They could have 3 or 4 diagnosis codes for a primary care visit. And I report all of those. I had to reformat one of my reports to make sure I could get all of them in there for the.
So you're seeing a trend up or down in any particular area?
It's hard for me to trend it because this is our first year.
But you don't get historical data?
I have global historical data.
All right.
So I can trend against the global historical data. I can tell you that by the end of December 2019, we had already seen more patients than they saw the previous year in its entirety.
Right.
So that trend I can see. I don't have like the diagnosis code data at a level that I could trend it. I'll have it myself and I'll be able to go year to year and trend on diagnosis right. codes because I've got the data now.
I'm just trying to figure out if, because I don't know enough about all the things going on there, but any of them attributable to bad conditions at home, whether it's emotional or cleanliness or whatever, or lack of food or...
The food insecurity we know is an issue,
right?
And that's why the kids are picking up their lunch and their breakfast at between 9 and 10 now at the high school, at all the schools in Bernalillo Public School District. Food's available to them. In terms of the behavioral health diagnosis, it runs the gamut. It runs the gamut of everything you see. You know, we're required to screen. This is a requirement of the feds of us. We're required to do this little behavioral health screening on every patient that we see. So we have a pretty good baseline of depression. And basically what the feds are screening for is for depression. They want to know. And depression is more prevalent than I would have ever imagined before I started looking at it at a data level right. in the community. Now, I'm not just going to say just the school, in the community.
And that's depression. The world we live in or something that...
I think it's the world we live in.
What can be done by the social worker?
Counseling. Yeah. That's the value of having the ability to talk to the patient about their issues. And, you can see people that go down the substance abuse line. And they might come to see Dr. Hartman because they want to stop using opioids. Well, they're not going to just do it with the other drug that he's going to give them. They're going to need support
right.
from the emotional side with the counselors. So the counseling part's really important.
I saw some supposed actual report about smoking in junior high and high school
mm-hmm.
and interviewed a lot of kids. Don't like cigarettes at all. 90% of them vape every day.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what we're finding around here too?
I don't have any data on vaping. I have no data on vaping. Anecdotally, I would say yes.
Only because does it cause any health issues that brings people into El Pueblo?
No, I can't say that we've seen anything like of that nature that would have brought kids into El Pueblo.
So that's more of a cultural thing like mm-hmm. tattoos.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way to compare yeah. it. Yeah.
Except that it's still nicotine.
It's deadly. It's deadly. Yeah. It's not good.
It's legal.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does the health community address that?
I don't like it.
Don't we federally subsidize tobacco growers still?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Well, that's a very confusing thing.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is.
Yeah. I guess that's a battle you can't win.
And the kid, yeah, it's one of those ones you can't win. And yeah, again, all you can do is try to educate. You know, we do that with our adult population. We certainly do it with the kid population at the school. Is
other wonderful things going on at El Pueblo?
I don't know. That's been pretty exciting doing the school.
You talked about possibly introducing some dental component to the clinic.
We would love to, but that's going to take some federal dollars to help us get that off the ground. That's very expensive. and we apply whenever the funding stream becomes available at the federal level. We apply for it. I think I'm 0-for-3 now. But
do you get graded?
You get graded.
So
yeah.
how much more extra credit do you need to get the money?
I don't think it has anything to do with that. We get a site review from the feds every 3 years, except they came in 2 years this time, which annoyed me. But the people that came 2 years ago, the financial advisor, who's a consultant to HRSA.
And what's HRSA?
HRSA is the Health Resources and Services Administration. Okay. That is CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is under HRSA. Bureau of Primary Health Care, BPHC, is under HRSA. So HRSA's Alex Azar is Secretary of Health and Human Services. And so he basically runs, so we have Big Pharma running our healthcare system now. But I editorialized there. Tried not to do that.
The truth is the truth.
But Yeah, so the funding, the consultant, the business consultant that came on that visit explained to our board of directors how broken the system for evaluation of those RFPs at the federal level was. It used to be, because I signed up years ago to be a reviewer, because right. I thought it would be informative to review, and then I would learn, you know, what could I do better with my own grant sure. applications? And of course, it never got picked. But back then, they would fly you to Washington. They'd put you in a room with, you know, six other people, mm-hmm. and you'd read like six different proposals. And then collaboratively, you would come up with the grade for those proposals. It's totally decentralized now. And there are multiple horror stories out there that people... people share about how bad and how broken the system is. So these guys that came 2 years ago, the lead, there's three people. There's a clinical person, a governance person, and a finance person. The lead guy, who was the governance guy, during the opening session with the board of directors present, looked at me and said, "So did you get any feedback from your last grant application?" And I kind of looked at him, like probably gave him deer in the headlights. And he sure. said to me, "It's not a trick question." He said, "We know what happens." So I told him what had happened on my last one. The only comment I got on that one was, "There's no justification. Your costs are too high," which made my head explode.
Sure.
Because the HRSA tracks all this data of all the community health centers in the country. Mm-hmm. We run at half the cost of the national average for the cost per patient per year. Why is that? Because we don't get all the federal money. We have to.
Right.
So to see that comment on your grant report that you got back was just like, what are you going to do? You know, and there's no appeal process.
Right.
You can't go run to Congressman Lujan and say, "Ben Ray, I can't believe what happened to me." You just
apply next time.
Go to the next one. So the last one, right. the most recent one, we were stellar on every category. One comment.
Yes.
We didn't do a good enough job explaining the need for dental.
Why does that need to be explained?
That's kind of how I had a whole budget for dental. I had almost a full page about dental. And that was the comment that I got back. And that's why I didn't get funded. It's frustrating.
Certainly. But the mechanics of it also, is there room at your current location to...
I would probably go off-site with dental.
Okay.
I would probably take it off-site.
Are you ever going to put on a second floor?
We can't. Not the design of that building. There's too many rammed
earth. Take over the laundromat?
There's too many rammed earth walls in there. I would not want to put a second floor up top of there. No, we definitely would go. Just like we did with, we got two behavioral health counselors down the street. We'd have to put dental somewhere down the street to be realistic.
Like UNM, you got 45 different offices to go to all around town.
I heard they were shutting a bunch of them down up at Sandoval Regional, but I haven't confirmed that yet. Yeah. So.
They're also going gangbusters, Sandoval yeah. Regional. That's a nice facility.
Yep. Yep. So. They got some new mill levy money, so.
It's always the money. Isn't that terrible? Mm-hmm. We got, what, $2 billion extra dollars in the state budget?
Yeah.
Before
the oil. before Putin blew up the oil thing.
But, you know, $1.61 a gallon for gas. Got
$1.55 at Santo Domingo when I drove down today.
How much?
$1.55.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's,
I can only buy 20 gallons at a time. So
I run diesel. So anytime diesel gets close to like $2.10 a gallon, I'm happy.
What else can we say nice about El Pueblo?
I don't know. I think we got it. I mean, I didn't really talk about Dr. Rankin's palliative care, but... you know, she spent a year doing a fellowship at UNM.
And what is palliative care?
Palliative care is kind of a bridge between your chronic disease progression and hospice.
Okay.
And a lot of people hear palliative care and they think it's hospice, and it's not. It's pretty it's like you've got COPD, and so, you know, you're having a hard time breathing constantly, and you're in pain, and you might have a few psych issues because you're in pain so much. So Rachel has kind of an interdisciplinary team. She's got a retired psychologist who works with her to talk to people about the psych piece.
Right.
And it's just, it's really an intermediate step as a transition to hospice. And it's amazing how many people are finding value in it. It's really, really astounding.
That leads me to what I hope is a good question. Mm-hmm. There's more and more interest nationally, possibly globally, aging in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the palliative care, she could have an intervention and say, Bob, Sally, yeah, whatever, it's time.
Well, don't, it gets, you shouldn't be about home. Yeah, I think the important thing there is that it gets talked about, you know, and absent that, you got people going from, I got sick, now I'm going to die.
Right.
You know, and so here you've got this transition where you bring the family together with the patient and you talk about, okay, here's, you know, a logical course of your disease progression. Here's what we can do now to keep you comfortable. And eventually you're going to get to this point and we'll help you transition to that point. I think it makes really good sense. I really very impressed with what she's put together. And I think our patients are really impressed with it too. So,
well, super. That's a great, yeah, great way to end. So Rick Edessa, Executive Director of Pueblo Community Services, over 40 years of service.
Absolutely.
And for KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico, and myself, Matthew Bronson, thank you all for listening. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.